Today's case show is on case 68 in the Book of Serenity. Case 68 is entitled Jashan's Swinging the Sword. Introduction: Inside the Heartland, the Emperor's Command. Outside the castle walls, the General's Order. Sometimes empowered at the gate, sometimes honored in the room. Tell me, who is this? Case. A monk asked Jashan, "How is it when getting rid of dust to see the Buddha?" Jashan said, "You should directly swing the sword. If you don't swing the sword, the fisherman stays in a nest." The monk brought it up to ask Shishuang, "How is it when getting rid of the dust to see the Buddha?" Shishuang said, "He has no country. Where will you meet him?" The monk returned and quoted this to Jashan. Jashan went up in the hall and said, "In the establishment of method and school, he does not compare to me. In profound talk entering the temple, I am still 100 steps behind Shishuang." Verse: the star brushing sword, the army washing weather, settling disorder, deferring the merit. Who else is it? One morning the haze of dust clears over the four seas. Robes hanging down, the imperial rule is naturally effortless. So, I want to thank everybody for doing such a wonderful job this morning in the Zendo. This is just about the perfect day. There are probably not 10 days in New Jersey that are this perfect, right? And so all the circumstances are cooperating to make this wonderful experience for everybody here. And this morning, people were working diligently in their practice. You know, a little while ago, I had the chance to get this Manjushri statue behind us in the on the altar, behind me on the altar. And when I saw it, I instantly fell in love with it. It's very dramatic. You know, the other Manjushri statue we had was very serene. It was this is a Tibetan style Manjushri, and the other Manjushri was Japanese style Manjushri, and actually, the Japanese style Manjushri was really a ripoff of the Chinese style Manjushri. So, as so many things are in Japanese culture, really derives from Chinese culture. The two bodhisattvas are really quite different. The bodhisattva Manjushri that's of Tibetan make is larger, very dramatic, right? I mean, he has a serene, he or she, bodhisattvas don't really have a gender, has a serene face, but that sword is raised over the head. And if you look, the sword is flaming. There's little flames coming off the sword. And the other Manjushri was compact and serene, and just holding the sword in front of him, her. And that's not just a cultural style, difference in cultural style, although it's certainly a difference in cultural style. You could say that it's two aspects of practice. So in this koan too, we're getting two aspects, these same two aspects of practice. So in this case, a monk goes to Jashan and says, how is it when getting rid of the dust to see the Buddha? In other words, look, you know, everybody has a busy life. We have jobs that take up a lot of our time and attention. And it's easy to lose touch with, lose track of our true nature. And this is why sesshin is so crucially important, right? That, you know, it's important to practice on a regular basis. But there's no substitute for sesshin. Because this is where the process of purifying body, heart, and mind really takes place. You know, you will definitely meet people who say, I have better sits when I just sit for an hour than I do at sesshin, but that's definitely not so. You know, basically, when you come to sesshin, you know, the first day is just settling the red dust, right? Letting the red dust settle. And it may be the case that you have a lot on your mind, and that keeps coming back. But sometime, especially people like yourselves who have been practicing for some time, you know, sometime around the end of day one, your mind is going to become more serene and empty. And the red dust begins to settle. You know, how is it when getting rid of the dust to see the Buddha? We're getting rid of the dust to see the Buddha. Jashan said, you should directly swing the sword. That's the sword of Manjushri. If you don't swing the sword, the fisherman stays in his nest. So that's a reference to a Chinese story. But basically the idea is, you know, you'll be caught, you'll be trapped, you'll be unable to go forward. So you have to swing the sword. And there's definitely an element of that, you know, to Zen practice. You know, Zen practice involves element of warriorship, right? You know, there's definitely a warrior dimension to Zen. It's not a life-taking sword, it's a life-giving sword. But you really, you know, to sit the way we've sat this morning, you really have to rouse yourself. And you really have to be able to draw on your energy, your key energy. When we work with, you know, many people here have been sitting for more than a decade. When you work with your hara, you know, for a decade, you know, when you sit down to meditate at 5 o'clock in the morning or 6 o'clock in the morning, rather, you know, you can call on this reserve of powerful energy. And you really have to do that. You know, it's interesting how much energy we really have. You know, I'm always trying to sell people on coming to sesshin. You know, basically there's a couple young people who come to the sits at the university. Two mainland Chinese guys. And I was really trying to talk them into coming to sesshin. They're not going to do it this time. Maybe they will in August, I don't know. But, you know, after an hour and a half of sitting, they are, they feel like they've had their, they've met their limits. You know, I've had my, had my limits. And one of the most amazing things about Zen is that we realize that those limits are mostly artificial, they're mostly imaginary. And even though they may seem real, you know, they really are imaginary. And a lot of Zen practice is learning how to is finding out that a barrier in yourself that you thought was impossible to break through, you can break through. And this happens to people all the time. You know, we sit many hours a day, and you know, you might be coming back to the cushion and thinking, I don't know if I can get through this sit, and then you draw on your chi energy, you focus your mind on your breath, on emptiness, and suddenly the minutes just roll by, you know, they just roll by, and an hour's gone in the snap of your fingers. And, you know, when this happens to beginners, you know, they don't necessarily appreciate it. I remember years ago, I used to not end the sit sometimes at 10:30. If I were engaged with somebody in Dokusan, I might continue the conversation for a little while. And that meant people out here in the Zendo were sitting here waiting for the day to be over. And I remember this woman came into Dokusan and the next day. And she was so mad at me. She said, she was so upset at me. She said, you know, it was 10:30, and it was all I could do to hold on. And then you stayed in the Dokusan room for another 10 minutes. And she said, you know, I was barely holding on. And then I said to her, but you made it, right? You made it through. And what I wanted her to say was, oh, you're absolutely right. Thank you for that insight. But she didn't. I think that was her last sesshin. And I'm so sorry that she made that mistake, right? Because I did her a big favor, and she didn't appreciate it. You know, in other words, you know, she had this image of herself as weak and helpless and exhausted. And I allowed her, not intentionally, but just because of Dokusan, now I'm much stricter, ending at 10:30. The Dokusan went on a little bit more, just 10 minutes, right? But at the end of the day, it seems like an eternity. And I wasn't being smart or sarcastic when I said, look, you sat through it. You know, she really felt she had been done an injustice. But I had not done her an injustice. I had done her a huge favor. You know, unfortunately, it's sometimes difficult to transform people's way of thinking about the world. You know, basically, that experience of being at your limit and then passing through the limit can be incredibly liberating. You know, I think it's the most liberating thing in the world. It's the reason people climb mountains, right? You know, I've been reading in the paper that it's just been like one death on Mount Everest after another. It's like record number of deaths. And people who don't understand mountain climbing must just shake their heads and think, what's up with those guys? I mean, in a way, that's true. Why do you always have to climb Everest? Right? They're much more interesting peaks, and it's like a It's like an escalator almost. It's just people lined up one after another trying to get up there. But, I don't know if you know the John Krakauer, Jonathan Krakauer. He's a writer I really like a lot. And he wrote about the famous incident, I think it was on K2, where all these people died, very experienced, Into Thin Air is the name of the book. And Krakauer talks about this horrible ordeal where, you know, basically these very experienced climbers tried to get to the top. And I think they did get to the top, but it was too late in the day and a storm came up. And lots of people died. One guy was even able to talk to his wife on the phone, on his portable phone, before he died. But, Krakauer ends the book and he says, you know, this is the craziest damn thing in the world. And I know it, but I'll do it again. You know. And you have to ask yourself, what would drive John Krakauer to do it again after he's seen all this suffering and all this? But I think it's that experience of getting outside the self. You know, you think, this is the limits to who I am. This is the limits. And all our lives, we're told we have these limits, right? You know the phrase, knowing your place. Knowing your place. You know, I know my limits. I know my limits, right? I think that's such a destructive mentality. It keeps people absolutely in ignorance about who they really are. No, I'm not saying that if your legs hurt, you shouldn't uncross your legs. That's not what I'm saying. We all reach a point where our legs hurt and it's okay to move our legs. But all the same, you know, sometimes when you don't move your legs, you have this, it's like you crack open and you enter this bigger place, right? And Zen is like we're not climbing up a mountain and we can't be, nobody has, to my knowledge, died from doing Zazen. Although sometimes at a long sit you might want to die. but it's achieving something very similar, right? It's a little bit like going up K2 sometimes. Day 2 of Sesshin is a little bit like going up K2, is where every step hurts, right? And every breath is just about all you can manage. Very much like meditation. But then, you know, it doesn't always happen, but sometimes it does happen that you crack yourself open and suddenly, you know, as they say in the sutras, no barriers are seen. And I myself am absolutely in love with that experience. You know, I think I got into Zen because I was depressed and unhappy. And coming to Zen was physically challenging for me, but I remember my first sesshin, and even though that sesshin was so painful and difficult, you know, after it was over, I really felt like I had sprouted wings. You know, like I could fly. That ability to be caught and then to summon up this energy, right, and to empty yourself out is the most amazing thing in the world. I guess it's something athletes know, and mountain climbers, and other people too who do things that require a lot of endurance and a lot of the ability to go through a barrier, you know. That's just, to me, that's intoxicating, right? Because, you know, in my Zen practice, that's happened to me again and again, where I think I'm at my limits, and then all of a sudden, you go through your limits. And I just think that's the most, that humans have that capacity is the most amazing thing in the world. In fact, it's supposed to be what separates humans in Buddhist mythology from gods and animals. You know, the gods actually can't change, or they change very slowly. So, you know, the god of love is really just love. That's how it's going to be. The god of war is pretty much, you know, on the war path all the time. I don't know if animals really are as inflexible as Buddhist mythology suggests. But it is probably the case that, you know, basically a deer will do what a deer has to do, and deer can't really change their basic behaviors. But humans are capable of stepping outside of themselves and entering the formless realm. And in my opinion, this is something few humans experience as directly as we do in doing Zazen. They do it in other ways, but I think we experience it very, very directly and dramatically. And most people who go through it climbing a mountain or something, I know they feel freer, but I don't necessarily think that they experience the emptiness at the center of the self. And in order to break through, when you break through the other side of that barrier, you know, you break through into that emptiness, it's like the walls have been blown out of the house and no boundaries are seen, and it's open in the 10 directions and so on. So, you know, some of Zen practice is inescapably about pushing yourself a little bit to a limit. It's important to be kind to yourself. You know, there are misconceptions of Zen. Zen is not about self-punishing. That's a very bad attitude. And the purpose of Zen is not to be in pain. You know, there was a period in Japanese Zen history where it's called the decadent period, where there were monks who could get into deep samadhi and then they would stick needles in their legs just to show how deep their samadhi was. Now, you know, I would say that's insane, right? But it's a misconception. You know, they thought Zen was about overcoming pain or something like that. So, you know, if your legs are screaming at you and you want to uncross your legs, it's okay, please do that. This is not about strength of will. But on the other hand, you know, you want to be kind to yourself, but when you push yourself you go to the limit, and you think, I can't do this, I can't go beyond this limit, and then you do, you know, actually one of the things you'll probably feel towards yourself is a kind of deep affection, or even love, for yourself. Zen practice is really about, part of Zen practice is really about that sword of Manjushri, of Wenshu, cutting through the limits of the self. And it takes a lot of energy and determination, right? And some people don't have that. But it's crucially important to, if you want to wake up, to cultivate that kind of spirit, kind of like a warrior spirit. It's just a fact. You don't have to go around pushing people down in the subway, but you do have to be a kind of warrior. So part of Zen practice is the Tibetan Manjushri practice, right? How is it when getting rid of the dust to see the Buddha? Jashan said, you should directly swing the sword. If you don't swing the sword, the fisherman stays in the net. You know, another way to think about this is, you know, if you don't draw the bow tightly, the arrow can't fly to the target. So in Zen thinking about practice, there's these two terms, ki in Japanese, ki and kyo, chi and kyo. And ki is the energy we build up on the cushion when we sit for 9 hours a day. And this is this is not mythology. You know, you're focusing your attention for hour after hour. And you're building up this extraordinary energy, not just a focus, but body-mind energy. You know, your body definitely functions in a very different way after you've been meditating for 4 or 5 hours. Your brain is functioning differently. You're building up this extraordinary ki, this extraordinary chi energy. Then the other part of Zen practice is kyo. It's like letting the arrow fly, see? So if you have a little ki, a little kyo, if you don't pull the string back all the way, the arrow can't fly straight to the bullseye, yeah? And so this is what we're sort of doing today. We're in our warrior mode. But there's this other dimension to the practice, which comes along, I would say, around day 3. And that's the Chinese Manjushri, right? You know, the first part of a sesshin, the first part of a practicing Zen even, is learning how to mobilize that energy and not to be daunted by challenges. So my student who condemned me for making her sit an extra 10 minutes was daunted by her challenges. But, if you practice Zen for a while, you're not daunted. It's like, you know, you become extremely resilient, you know, really resilient. Everything bad that can happen to people happens to people, right? It's just a fact. You know, people get cancer, people who don't deserve to die, die. People get hit by cars, you know, they don't deserve it. You know, people lose their jobs. They don't, you know, these things happen. Everything that can happen bad to people happens. And, you know, actually people can become very fearful people even in the absence of real challenges, real difficulties. So, you know, we develop a kind of a habit of being closed up or being cautious. And that really locks us in a lot of ways. And, you know, Zen is about challenging yourself by going to your limits, going to your barriers. And, you know, and life also hands you barriers, right? You know, life hands you things that are challenging and difficult. But, you know, if you keep practicing Zen, I think you're able to, you know what you have to do. You just have to get up and deal with it. And you know that you have that energy to deal with things. You know you can do it. You know, people who go through this process of being at a barrier and then breaking through, being at a barrier and breaking through, I think it definitely helps them in anything they do in life. Okay, so this is the first part of the koan. But there's a second part of the koan. After the monk asked Jashan, how is it when getting rid of dust? Jashan says, take the sword. He goes to Shishuang. He says, how is it when getting rid of dust? And Shishuang says, he has no enemy. He has no country, rather. Where will you meet him? This is a different, this is the day three mentality, day three awareness, right? Imperturbable calm, luminous emptiness. This is Buddha mind, right? So, you know, we have challenges. The sit goes on too long for whatever reason. Our knee hurts, you know, our back hurts, whatever. You rouse that energy, you push yourself into the barrier and you break through. But around day three of Sesshin, you know, you're in a different place, typically. There's still pain in your legs and so on. But now we are in our, we're closer to or in our Buddha mind. And this is like a great serene space where, you know, basically not a blade of grass is stirring, not the slightest breeze is blowing, and it's open in all directions. This is the beautiful mind of deep samadhi on day three of Sesshin. Imperturbable, absolutely luminous, clear. The mind is like, sometimes the koans, I mean the sutras say the mind is like water. You know, our minds are so far from being like clean water. They're full of junk, right? But around day three of Sesshin, day four of Sesshin, the mind is just luminous and clear. When you hear a bird, there's nothing between you and the bird. When you see the grass, there's nothing between you and the grass. You know, when the Buddha woke up, he said, on heaven and earth, you know, basically, I am the only enlightened one. On heaven and earth, I am the only enlightened one. And you could say to yourself, what an egotistical thing to say, right? You know, there might be somebody else who's... But the point, the Buddhist point is, you know, when you really break through to your true nature, there is no longer any barrier between yourself and anything. And everything is my true self. Everything is my true self. This is a day... post day three consciousness, right? And if you go through this process again and again and again and again, you know, this gets deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And so, you know, there's this serene, imperturbable Buddha nature in yourselves that is like that Chinese Manjushri. It's hidden in the shadows, and you see its luminous face illuminated by the candle, right? Holding back in the shadows, but utterly unchanging, unmoving, serene. And this is like, if you go there enough, this is enlightenment itself. If you stay there long enough, you'll be totally transformed. So we're in, right now you could say that we're in our Jiashan phase of the Sesshin. And around day three, we'll be in our Shishuang phase of the Sesshin. And you can't get to Shishuang without going through Jiashan. You know, I used to make a joke about this, you know, but sometimes people who know me know I do Zen. And I go to Sesshin quite regularly. So, but people who don't say, where are you going? And I'll say, I'm going to retreat. And they have the funniest ideas about retreats, right? Where, you know, we sit in a circle and so on, and so we talk. And there's no, let me just say, I'm 100% sure there's no chance of meeting that second Manjushri without going through the first Manjushri. There's no possibility of meeting Shi Shuang's Manjushri without going through Jia Shan's Manjushri. And that's because people are people live in illusion, right? You know, people live in illusion. Human beings live in a world of ideas and symbols that aren't real. And we secrete ideas and symbols to protect ourselves the way an oyster secretes to create its shell and protect itself. And as soon as we open our eyes, we start doing it again. And as soon as we stop the thinking machine, we start doing it again. So, you know, you close up, but you open up, and then you close up, and you open up, and you close up, and open up. And you could say, well, when is that going to stop? But it's never going to stop. But it's very important to get out of your shell. You know, it's a human mind is a samsara mind, you know, in many ways. You know, if you look at the world, you know, I don't know how people can be, how people can be not persuaded by this, you know, because, you know, I mean, I could go through a whole list of things, right, that where you say, why don't people wake up? Why don't people respond? Why don't people do something? But, you know, all these oysters are in their shell secreting, 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 secreting. And, you know, the solution is something like Sesshin, is practicing coming up to your limitation and breaking through and developing the confidence in the process so that that doesn't scare you, doesn't frighten you to do that. You make a life out of doing this, right? I would say this is a liberating life where you work to your limits, you go to the barrier, you break through the barrier, and then it's like, ah, I see the world again clearly. You know, I think that's what life is all about, myself. There's a very famous book on Buddhism called After Enlightenment, The Laundry by Jack Kornfield. After Enlightenment, The Laundry. But I think feel free to quote me on this, I think Jack Kornfield is 100% wrong. I think it's after the laundry, the enlightenment. See, because I think the whole purpose of being alive is to cultivate awakened mind. And I really think Jack has it wrong, right? It's like Zazen practice does help us in our lives. It absolutely does. But it's not just a tool to be more effective at work or something like that. You know, I believe that enlightenment is the highest thing. I think if people are trapped in samsara, but they're born... Yeah, I think they're like they're born craving liberation, right? You know, people are trapped in samsara, but I think people crave liberation with their whole hearts. They take drugs, they drink a lot, they engage in all kinds of self-destructive behaviors, they become addicted to their cell phones because they're trying to get outside of themselves. And all of these strategies actually make it worse. They actually bury themselves more under more layers of illusion. But there's something inside of people that wants to be enlightened. You would never guess from looking at society, but I think it's so important to put that first in your life. And I thank you for doing that and coming here to practice Zen. You're putting that first in your life. Putting that first in your life doesn't mean you live in a monastery, but it does mean that you make a practice of cracking yourself open and encountering the Buddha inside, yeah, over and over again. The star brushing sword, the army washing weather, settling disorder, deferring the merit. Who else is it? One morning the haze of dust clears over the four seas, robes hanging down, the imperial rule is naturally effortless. There's so many of these things in the koans are references to Chinese culture and history. So it would be like, if I were to write a commentary on the koans, I could use things from America. Like I could say, swinging through Brooklyn on his spider webs, Spider-Man stands on the top of the building. I shall return, says MacArthur, right? It would be like that. So unless you were saturated with American culture, you wouldn't understand what the hell I was talking about. This is the same thing here. But I think we get the general gist of it all the same. You have to work hard in sesshin. But at some point, it becomes effortless. And it doesn't become effortless. It's not going to be effortless on day one, but around day four, even though you're trying hard, it becomes effortless. And that's because you're no longer identifying with yourself. You're identifying with that part, that intelligence that is telling you to wake up. So please listen to that intelligence.